un grand plaisir de recevoir pour la deuxième fois, je crois, mon collègue Ville Tidema, ici au Collège de France. La première fois, c'était il y a très longtemps, c'était il y a bien une vingtaine d'années. Monsieur Idema, que tous les spécialistes de littérature, et je dirais même le grand public intéressé à la littérature chinoise et aux travaux, aux traductions en langue anglaise ou néerlandaise, dans laquelle il a publié énormément, connaissent bien, a été formé à l'Institut de sinologie de l'Université de Leiden, qui est un des grands instituts sinologiques européens, et au Japon. Et il a fait l'essentiel de sa carrière d'abord à l'Université de Leiden, donc où il a été professeur depuis 1976, puis il a été appelé en 1999 pour occuper une chaire prestigieuse à l'Université Harvard, où il a donc enseigné jusqu'à maintenant. Are you formally retired now?
No, next year.
Bon, donc où il est à la veille de sa retraite, de prendre sa retraite, et de retourner, si je puis dire, au pays, après avoir donc exercé une douzaine d'années à Harvard. Je ne vais pas vous mentionner les nombreuses responsabilités administratives et éditoriales qu'a exercé M. Idema, mais j'en voudrais au moins en mentionner une parce que j'y étais associé. C'est que nous avons été ensemble pendant une petite dizaine d'années peut-être, co-éditeurs de la revue Tongpao, qui, comme vous le savez sans doute, a été jusqu'à récemment une entreprise conjointe du Collège de France et de l'Université de Leiden, bien qu'avec l'internalisation des publications, ceci ne soit plus tout à fait vrai. Enfin, Tongpao est toujours basé au Collège, mais ne l'est plus à l'Université de Leiden. L'œuvre publiée de Ville Tidema est véritablement immense. Je dois dire que je connaissais un certain nombre de ses travaux, mais quand j'ai vu la liste de ses publications, j'étais vraiment impressionné. Elle porte pour sa plus grande partie sur toutes les formes de la littérature chinoise qu'on appelle parfois vernaculaire, c'est-à-dire le théâtre, le roman, la nouvelle, ainsi qu'un certain nombre de genres de littérature qu'on est convenu d'appeler populaire, tels que des pièces à chanter, des choses comme ça, dont il nous parlera d'ailleurs pendant ses conférences. La littérature en écriture de femmes, Nushu aussi, sur laquelle il a beaucoup publié, et j'en passe. Et sur tout cela, donc, Ville Tidema a publié non seulement une quantité d'ouvrages et d'articles de fond, mais encore, ou bien seul, ou bien en collaboration avec d'autres collègues, un grand nombre de traductions, de manuels, d'introductions, aussi bien pour les spécialistes que pour le grand public. Et à ce sujet, je mentionne encore une fois sa liste impressionnante de publications en langue néerlandaise, en hollandais, à travers lesquelles il a vraiment fait à son actif une œuvre énorme de diffusion de la littérature chinoise en Hollande. Pour le public du collège, ce mois-ci, Ville Tidema a choisi, je crois que c'était un peu sur ma suggestion, de puiser dans son inépuisable érudition pour traiter d'un sujet qui m'a toujours beaucoup intéressé, à savoir le droit dans la littérature chinoise. Nous sommes aujourd'hui assez nombreux en France à travailler sur l'histoire du droit chinois, et je me souviens qu'il y a quelques années, j'avais dans un de mes séminaires consacré quelques séances à examiner un certain nombre de huaben, c'est-à-dire de contes, de nouvelles, si vous voulez, en langue vernaculaire, publiées au XVIIe siècle, et à les examiner pour voir tout ce qu'on y trouvait sur le droit, et en particulier sur la pratique judiciaire, qui s'avère extrêmement intéressant, dans la mesure où ça révèle une familiarité avec le droit et les procédures judiciaires dans le grand public, qui est tout à fait intéressante. Les aspects dont va traiter aujourd'hui M. Idema, vous les avez vus en lisant les résumés que j'ai diffusés avec l'invitation. Aujourd'hui, donc la conférence d'aujourd'hui est consacrée à un genre extrêmement intéressant qui est le jugement fictif, qui était à la fois un genre pour les candidats aux examens et un genre littéraire en soi. Enfin, ça, j'en dis pas plus. Nous allons tout de suite écouter M. Idema là-dessus. Donc, je vous rappelle que les séances des trois semaines qui suivent la semaine d'aujourd'hui seront consacrées, donc la semaine prochaine, aux animaux au tribunal, c'est-à-dire à un certain nombre de fables mettant en scène des animaux et dans des scènes de contestation judiciaire. Tout ceci, évidemment, extrait de la littérature narrative. Quant aux deux dernières séances, elles seront consacrées à un des grands héros de la justice chinoise, le juge Bao, appelé de divers noms, et en particulier Bao Longtu, d'après son titre officiel. Il était secrétaire du pavillon Longtu sous les Song, donc, et les affaires traitées par le juge Bao ont donné naissance à toute une littérature à la fois de romans policiers et aussi ce dont il sera plus particulièrement en question les semaines prochaines, et aussi de poèmes à chanter dont l'interprétation est tout à fait intéressante. Donc voilà, je passe donc la parole à Vitidema pour la première de ces quatre conférences.
Well, thank you very much for this kind introduction. Also, thank you very much for the invitation to come to Paris. It's always a great pleasure for somebody from the provinces and from the smaller European countries to be allowed to spend time in Paris. And I have to apologize for not speaking in French. My school French, unfortunately, is not up to that job. Now, both France and the Netherlands have a long tradition of sinology. The French tradition, admittedly, is longer and richer, but starting with Hoffmann and Schlegel, Leiden University can pride itself on a continuous tradition of more than 150 years of teaching Chinese. The French and Dutch traditions of sinology not only originated at quite different moments of time, but also in quite different circumstances and motivations. If I am allowed a certain degree of simplification in order to highlight a contrast, I would say that a French tradition, which we may trace back to the royal patronage of the Jesuit mission in Manchu China, was born from the ambition for empire, which resulted in a desire to know China and the Chinese language even before China had been conquered, which of course would never happen. Whereas the Dutch tradition was born from the approach of merchants to the practical problems of administering an empire after the British had kindly returned Java to the Dutch following the defeat of Napoleon. The guiding principle of Dutch colonial administration in what is now Indonesia was the maximization of profit. This meant that the colonial possessions were administered as cheaply as possible and that the local population were allowed to conduct their internal affairs according to their own law and custom. Now, the Chinese in the Indonesian archipelago occupied a somewhat anomalous position in the Dutch colonial edifice. As esteemed collaborators of the Dutch, they occupied in many ways a privileged position vis-à-vis the local population. For a long time, they were subjected to Dutch law to be increasingly assimilated to the local population over the course of the 19th century, only to see their position improve once again from the early 20th century onward, when the rising tide of Chinese nationalism inside and outside the Dutch East Indies started to worry the colonial authorities. But throughout the centuries of Dutch colonial administration, Chinese family law and inheritance law continued to apply to the Chinese populations. This and some other issues meant that the colonial administration over the long 19th century felt an increasing need for Chinese interpreters who could serve as specialists for Chinese affairs. When attempts to create a body of interpreters by placing youngsters with Chinese family failed, the Ministry of Colonial Affairs eventually, and only very reluctantly, decided to move the training of Chinese interpreters to the Netherlands, where Gustav Schlegel became the first professor of Chinese language and literature in 1877. The practical needs of Chinese studies at Leiden have meant that knowledge of Chinese law was an issue of major concern, especially from the early 20th century onward, when China started to drastically revise its traditional body of law in order to join the modern world. By the logic of Dutch colonial administration, these new codes also apply to the Chinese in the Dutch East Indies as far as family and inheritance law were concerned. And so the study of Chinese law came to occupy an important place in Dutch sinology, especially in the publications of Marius van der Valk and Marinus Meyer. The emphasis on Chinese law resulted in the case of Robert van Gulik in his translation of the Tang Yin Pishe and his Judge Dee novels, and in the case of my own doctorvater, Anthony Hulsaway, in his well-known studies on Remnants of Han Law of 1955 and his Remnants of Qin Law of 1985. Now, when I arrived at Leiden as a freshman student of Chinese language and culture in 1963, Hulsaway was not working on Chinese law of any period, but had become interested in the question of the relationship between the current text of the Xueji and the Hanshu, and in the chapters on the Western regions. This would eventually result in his China in Central Asia, the early stage of 1979, which he published in collaboration with his good friend Michael Lowy. When I had passed my bachelor examination, I would join his Hanshu seminar, where a small group of us would read our way slowly, not only through the main text of the treatises on the Western regions, but also through the interminable commentaries of the Qing dynasty philologist who traced the riverbeds of long ago vanished streams in what is now Xinjiang in painstaking and excruciating detail. It didn't mean that Hulsaway didn't want us to study Chinese law. Every year in fall, when old and new students met with their teachers to hear when and where each course would be taught, he would alert us to the courses taught by Professor van der Valk in the Faculty of Law. From 1950, van der Valk held an honorary appointment in the Faculty of Law to teach Chinese law and would teach one course each year. Over-diligent nerd as I was in those days, I immediately in my first year tried to attend the lectures by Professor van der Valk. He taught his class in a very small room in the tower of the Count's Castle in Leiden, which had been the stone house of the Counts of Holland, but which had later been handed over to the city of Leiden to serve as courthouse and prison, before it had been taken over by the university's Faculty of Law. My first encounter with Chinese law was not very successful. Van der Valk presupposed knowledge of either Chinese or Dutch law, and I had none of it. The topic he had selected to treat in the fall of 1963 was the notion of the onrechtmatige daad, or wrongful act, in Chinese law. But all I remember from the few classes I attended is that a wrongful act was, and probably still is, a very complicated issue in Dutch jurisprudence. I felt, of course, vindicated in my decision to skip his classes when a few years later, China, in the throes of the Cultural Revolution, would declare all law irrelevant in view of the paramount importance of class struggle. For a young man like me in the 1960s, who was interested in the Chinese development model, the study of Chinese law was, like Chinese law itself, a thing of the past. The Faculty of Law of Leiden University apparently felt the same, and the position of van der Valk was not filled upon his retirement in 1978. In my own academic career, my main interest soon shifted from contemporary social developments to traditional vernacular literature. But in my Dutch language publication, I ranged much more widely. And it's probably fair to say that to the extent that I have established a reputation among my countrymen, I am best known as a translator of classical Chinese poetry. One of the poets I have been engaged in with more intensively has been the great Tang Dynasty poet Bai Juyi. This engagement eventually resulted in a major Dutch language anthology of the writings of Bai, covering both his poetry and prose, also providing examples of the compositions he wrote at or in preparation for the many examinations he participated in his early career in order to enhance his visibility and boost his career. But once one deals with the Tang poet, beyond the anthology pieces, one needs, as Robert de Rotour already realized many decades ago, a detailed understanding of the Tang bureaucracy and its recruitment procedures. In my work on Bai Juyi, I have on many occasions benefited from the scholarship of de Rotour, especially as displayed in his Traité des examens, traduit de la nouvelle histoire des Tang. This work was originally published in 1932, but I used the revised and corrected edition of 1976. In the introduction to the revised edition, the elderly de Rotour mentions that he had received various suggestions for improvements of his work when it was first published from Arthur Whaley, and draws especially attention to the fact that Whaley had told him that his, that is to say de Rotour's, definition of the word pan, or judgment, had been wrong. Now, the pan was a well-established genre of writing in the Tang. As Titung Yang has stressed in a recent article in Clear, Tang bureaucrats at all levels continuously made decisions on administrative and legal matters, which as written judgments were called pan. But on top of that, the pan was especially important because it was the only written genre tested in the selection examinations of the Tang dynasty. As is well known, the Tang examination system was quite different from the examination system of late imperial China during the Ming and Qing dynasties. The Tang dynasty knew a distinction between qualification examinations and selection examinations. Passing the qualification examination in any one of its categories qualified one for official service, but did not promise an appointment. For that one had to present oneself for a selection examination where one was tested on appearance, speech, calligraphy, and judgment. In the early years of the dynasty, the candidates were presented with an actual difficult case and were asked to come up with a verdict in clear parallel prose, but later they were presented with hypothetical cases. The importance of the genre is shown by the fact that the Wenyuan Yinghua of the early Song, which is a huge anthology of prose writings from the Tang dynasty, includes over 1,000 examination pan judgments of the Tang dynasty. Bai Juyi, of course, also wrote such pan when he presented himself for his examination, and de Rotour included a translation of one of Bai Juyi's pieces in his Traité des examens. Even more, Bai's collected works contain a set of 100 pan or judgments on hypothetical cases, which he is believed to have written in preparation to the decree examination, which was conducted in 802, at which the candidates had to write 3 judgments. For me, like many others of my generation, the authoritative introduction to the life and works of Bai Juyi was Arthur Whaley's The Life and Times of Bai Juyi of 1949. Whaley, as we saw from his correspondence with de Rotour, was a self-proclaimed expert on the pan, and he provided the following characterization of the genre in The Life and Times of Baijiu. Whaley writes, "Highly antithetical, stilted clauses, archaic vocabulary, and various other obligatory mannerisms combined to make the judgment the most pedantic and artificial of all literary forms." Whaley then has some fun in writing his own judgment in English legalese, employing an antiquated spelling to convince the readers of the ludicrous nature of the pun, and goes on to, in his eyes, more important matters. One is left to wonder how the tongue bureaucracy could ever function if it recruited its members by writing such nonsense. In view of Whaley's blistering condemnation of the genre, I waited long before even daring to have a peek at the relevant chapters in the work of Baijiu. But once I finally did so, I was pleasantly surprised. Yes, Baijiu's judgments are written in parallel prose, but the pan are mercifully short, absolutely clear, and almost devoid of allusion. Rather than providing you, like Whaley, with my own pastiche of a Baijiu judgment, I will provide you with one example in translation, which will be a judgment concerning a refusal to follow one's father's order for burying his concubine with him. When A died, he ordered his son to bury his concubine with him, but his son married her off. Someone accused him of disobeying his father's order, but the son said, "I didn't dare make my father commit a crime." It's the same as what I do in law school nowadays. You present your students with a hypothetical case, and the student, there are two possible opinions, and the student has to come up with a verdict. Now, the pan goes, "When one observes the son's behavior to comfort the father's heart, then nothing is better than obeying the father's order. But as far as refuting delusions and adhering to the rites is concerned, one has to fulfill the way of the son. A, the father, fell short of propriety in establishing his character and sank into debauchery when he departed from life. He ordered his son to commit evil because while alive, he lacked all restraint with regards to sex. If his beloved concubine would join him in the grave, he would even after his death bring harm to other people. By disobeying his father, the son disregarded his words, but if he would have followed them, a crime would have been committed. Even though during the 3 years of mourning, one should honor one's father and make no changes, it is impossible to condemn one's parent to an unsavory reputation because he misspoke just a single time. Of course he should marry her off. How could he have obeyed evil? Moreover, filial piety depends on considering the outcome. So this is similar to the way Prince Wei Ke dealt with the order of his father to bury his favorite concubine. As the case is different from changing what is proper, it doesn't hurt the inimitable way in which Master Meng Zhuang maintained his father's former servants in their positions. It is proper that he forgot the words that reached his ears so he could display his filial piety that followed his heart." Now, each of the 100 courses starts with a short description of a moral, legal, or institutional dilemma, and the judgment in the case of Baijiu in each case comes down on the side of well-informed reason. The language may at times be borrowed from earlier works for additional emphasis, but obvious allusions tend to be limited to two pretty obvious allusions at the very end. Baijiu apparently enjoyed quite a reputation during his lifetime for his sharp legal mind and would spend an important part of his bureaucratic career in legal administration. So one can only wonder how Whaley came up with his outrageous characterization of the pan. To do so, we will have to delve into the history of the genre and its criticism. Since times immemorial, decisions have been reached in conflicts and court cases, but it takes a while before the language of the judicial process involved is standardized and become a specific technical language all its own, which then becomes the cultural capital of judicial specialists. As proof that the judicial language had developed its own characteristics not later than the Western Han Dynasty, some scholars quote the following Shiji anecdote concerning the use of Jiang Tang, one of the so-called harsh officials, and I will quote it in full because it concerns rats, which will become a major topic of my next talk. Jiang Tang hailed from Du. His father was an aide for the Chang'an marketplaces. Once, when he went out, he left Tang, then only a child, in charge of the lodgings. When he returned, a rat had stolen the meat, and the enraged father administered a beating to Tang. By digging out the hole, Tang caught the thieving rat together with what was left of the meat. He accused the rat and had him bastinadoed, whereupon he took down his statement in writing. Following interrogation and trial, he discussed the fitting punishment. Bringing out both the rat and the meat, he conducted a judicial dismemberment in front of the hall. When his father saw this and also noted that his phraseology was like that of an experienced judicial officer, he was amazed and from then on had him clerk law cases. The genre of the pan as a written genre is usually traced back to the collected cases connected to the name of the Han scholar and politician Tung Chung Shu. Once upon a time, a collection of 242 cases and their decisions by Tung Chung Shu circulated as the Chunqiu Jueyu, or criminal cases decided according to the principles of the spring and autumn. Only six of these cases have been preserved. To what extent all these cases can be credited to Tung is, of course, an open question, especially as some of these cases share already some of the characteristics of the hypothetical cases of the Tang in designating the parties in the conflict as A, B, C, Jia, Yi, Bing. The principles of spring and autumn seem to imply that the judge should not only apply the letter of the law, but should also consider circumstances and motivations in reading a verdict, as the following example may demonstrate. At that time, there was a problematical case. A had no son of his own and had raised B, whom he had found as an abandoned infant by the side of the road as his own child. When this son grew up, he committed the crime of murder and informed A of the circumstances, whereupon A hit B. How should A be judged? Chung Shu decided A had no son, but saved and raised B, even though he was not his biological son, who could take his place. The odes say the mulberry insect has young ones and the sphex carries them away. So the spring and autumn intends that fathers should shield their sons. A fittingly hit his son and should not be sentenced. As is clear from these examples, the verdicts, the pan in this case, are phrased in straightforward, simple prose. And when the classics are quoted, the source is mentioned. During the Tang II, verdicts in actual cases were often given in simple prose. For the first collections of judgments drawn up in parallel prose, filled with illusions, we have to wait for the Longjin Feng Shui path, or dragon sinews and phoenix marrow judgments, a large collection of model judgments by a man called Jiang Zuo, who lived from roughly 660 to 740. Jiang is now best known as the probable author of You Xian Ku, A Visit to a Cavern of Immortals, a long early Chuanqi tale only preserved in Japan. He is also the author of a collection of anecdotes, Chao Ye Qian Zai, or Combined Records of Court and Country, which is often criticized by bibliographers for its disorganized characters. In his own day, he was one of the most celebrated writers. While we know the titles of numerous other collections of model judgments by known and unknown Tang Dynasty authors, Jiang's Longjin Feng Shui Pan is the only collection to have been preserved alongside the exemplary judgments of Bai Juyi. It is the judgments in Jiang's collections that seem to match the description of Arthur Whaley. Not only are Jiang's judgments couched in parallel prose throughout, but almost every line contains at least one allusion, as the following example will show. And this concerns a judgment concerning a one-eyed general. The general of the flying cavalry, Liao Kong, has an extraordinary strength in his arms, and his bowmanship on horseback surpasses all others. But as he is blind in one eye, one fears that he may not be fit to wait on His Majesty. One would like to release him from service, but also values his physical abilities. The judgment goes, to serve as the limbs of one's lord and superior depends on one's heart and one's arms. Once Liao Bang had found Fan Kuai, he could wipe away all pestilential airs. Once Cao Cao had obtained Tian Wei, he could pacify the whole cosmos. Liao Kong's strength equals that of Wu Huo, and his bravery resembles that of Chuan Zhu. In no way he lacks the talents of Meng Yue, and he has all the features of Ren Bi. As for scaling the walls and then cutting the clothes, there is none ahead of him wherever he goes. As for carrying stones and hitting others, there is none who can show greater courage. Because he broke through the defenses of the Gate of Ji, he is famed for his extraordinary power, and as he can lift the gate doors of a great city, his remarkable courage earns everyone's respect. In ancient times, Zixia continued to teach in west of the river after he had gone blind, and Zuo Chou even wrote his book in Eastern Lu after he has lost his eyesight. Yin Khan was one-eyed, but still served as governor on the board of the Yangtze, and the emperor of Wei was moved to sighs when his daughter's marriage to Ding Yi was stopped because of the latter's squint. I mean, this has a personal touch for me. One uses the large to cover the small, one abandons the short to follow the long. Rivers and marshes accept muddied streams, and mountains and swamps hide disabled animals. When a snake brings a brilliant pearl, one doesn't reject it because of a minor blemish. When a giant white jade equals several cities in value, it will not be discarded because of a minute flaw. When great timber can be enlisted, what's the hurt of a minor defect? As one needs what is required, one should follow the old rules. Now, the first scholar to mention the pan of Jiang Zuo and those of Bai Juyi in one breath was the southern Song statesman and polymath Hong Mai. In his Rongjai Shui Bi, we find the following discussion of the genre. During the Tang Dynasty, the Ministry of Personnel considered four aspects in its selection and choice of personnel. The first aspect was the person. A fine and tall figure was required. The second aspect was language. A clear and correct choice of words was required. The third was calligraphy. A beautiful hand of writing standard script was required. The fourth was judgment. A convincing argument was required. Because they considered calligraphy an art during the Tang, there were no people who were not skilled in the standard script, and because they esteemed the judgment so highly, there was none who was not well schooled in the genre. Moreover, judgments had to be written in parallel style. Examples are the Dragon Tendon and Phoenix Marrow judgments by Jiang Zuo and the Hypothetical judgments by Bai Juyi that are still available today. From the court down to the district, all acted like this. And then he adds, the common people very much like to talk about trifling anecdotes, leavened with humor, and such judgments are classified as funny judgment, hua pan. In fact, during the Tang, it was like this, quite different from the situation nowadays, when it's acceptable that people only write one character when they decide on a case with brush in hand. Stressing the difference between the pan as an examination genre and the actual judgment. Hong Mai was also the first person to draw attention to the obvious differences between the judgments of Jiang and those of Bai when he returned to the genre later in his huge collection of notes and informal essays. And he writes, the histories of the Tang state that Jiang Zuo was a child prodigy who graced the court with his fine writings. Whenever he composed a text, he was done so as soon as he put his brush to paper. And on the 8 occasions he took part in a decree examination, he always came out first. But the books by him that have been transmitted to our age are only the combined records of Court of Country and the Dragon Tendon and Phoenix Marrow judgments. But the incidents recorded in the combined records are trifling and isolated and often contain scandalous language. The 100 judgments are only a literary model for that age and all can be classified as parallel prose. All Jiang knows is to pile up illusion, but when it comes to judging the crime or discussing the law, he is incapable of deep incisiveness. There's not a single text that's worth reading, not even a single couplet worth savoring. But when it comes to the hypothetical judgments by Bai Juyi, you can never have enough of them the more you read. So let me here record some of Bai's judgments. And he goes on and on, quoting Bai Juyi. Judgments like these do not go against human feelings and accord with the intention of the law. In citing the classics and quoting the histories, his comparisons are very clear. Now, but whereas Hong Mai had considered the Long Jin Feng Shui Pan and the judgments of Bai Juyi as very comparable works, the 18th century editors of the Suku Chuanshu realized that the intentions of these two works were quite different. Whereas Bai Juyi provided models of text such as one might write in the examinations and perhaps even use in the real world of crime and punishment, Jiang Zuo used the format of the pan to provide examination candidates with a ready stock of allusions from which they might choose in writing pan. As a thematically arranged collection of allusions, the editors of the Suku Chuanshu classified Jiang's Long Jin Feng Shui Pan, therefore, with the Lei Shu, the encyclopedias, or classified excerpts. And in their catalog, they provided the following explanation of their decision. In the system of the Tang, personnel was chosen in the selection examinations on the basis of person, language, calligraphy, and judgments. Nowadays, we still can find many of these judgments in the Wenyuan Yinghua. The majority of these are anonymous. The only independent collections that have come down are the judgments included by Bai Juyi in his collection, in his collected works and by Jiang Zuo. Zhuyi's judgments strive for smooth eloquence, but these of Jiang for gorgeous beauty. They each embody the single style of a period. In his Hongmai ridiculed Jiang Zuo for piling up allusions without any relevance to deciding the crime or discussing the law. But this compilation of Jiang Zuo is intended for examination preparation. It is written to provide matching allusions. It has not been written to establish the law, but aims to complete and to be complete in providing references. And all his words are fitting. So one cannot point this out as a defect of Jiang Zuo. Now, this means that the closest parallel to the work of Jiang Zuo is provided by a collection of 120 poems, Yongwu poems, of his contemporary Li Jiao. This collection is entitled Zaiyong and circulated as an independent work in the first half of the 8th century. Li Jiao's poems, each on a different topic, are arranged very much in the sequence of an encyclopedia. And in each 8-line, 5-word regulated poem, each single line contains at least one relevant allusion. One has to assume that both the pan of Jiang Zuo and the poems of Li Jiao were accompanied by commentaries that explained each of these allusions very much in the manner of primary school textbooks such as Meng Chou. Jiang Zuo's judgments circulated indeed in later times with such an extensive commentary, but I'm not aware of any such pre-modern commentary for Bai Zhuyi's judgments. The popularity of handy encyclopedias such as Yiwen Leiju, classified excerpts of belles lettres of a slightly later date, made compilations such as Jiang Zuo's Longjin Feng Shui Pan and Li Jiao's Zaiyong largely irrelevant and resulted in many misunderstandings as to their intended use. Now, for the impact of the pan in literature, it's interesting to have a look at the Hua Pan, which were already mentioned by Hongmai, Hua Pan or funny judgments. A precise definition of Hua Pan is lacking, but it would appear that a term can cover any wittily expressed verdict in a curious or scandalous case, preferably one involving courtesans or monks, or even better, both. Hongmai describes Hua Pan as a contemporary fashion, but Tang authors already record cases of judges who allowed their wit free rein in deciding minor cases. The Kaiwen Kaixin Lu preserve, for instance, the following anecdote. During the Tang, Pei Quan's son Xu also served as prefect of Henan, that's to say lawyer. Xu loved to make fun of people. On one occasion, two women together submitted a statement in which they disputed each other the ownership of a cat. The statement said, if this is your cat, then it's your cat, but if it isn't your cat, then it isn't your cat. And Xu had a good laugh and judged as follows in a little poem. The kitten doesn't know its master. It catches mice around the house. There is no need for you to fight. Just give your pussy to the boss. He then kept the cat, and the two fighting parties did not pursue the case. As is clear from this example, in such cases, the judgment did not have to be composed in parallel prose, but a poem, or later in Song Dynasty times, a lyric would do as well, as long as the wording was memorable. The only work, to the best of my knowledge, to provide us with an anthology of such Hua Pan, or funny judgments, is Lo Ye's Zui Weng Tan Lu, or Records of the Conversations of a Tipsy Greybeard. This thematically arranged collection of anecdotes, only preserved in a single 14th century copy, probably dates from circa 1300. It contains one section entitled Huapan Kungan, or Funny Judgments Court Cases. It consists of 15 items, each consisting of a briefly narrated court case, followed by the verdict, which is clearly the raison d'être of the piece. The majority of these cases concern courtesans, and three cases concern monks. If these items are the best examples of the genre, it is perhaps not surprising that we lack later collections along these lines, as the following lame examples may show. The first example is how Jiang Kuei judged a courtesan's complaint with a lyric. In the days that Jiang Kuei served as judge in Tanzhou, the courtesan Yang Saisai lodged an accusation against a patron who had broken his promise and owned her money. So she presented her statement of accusation to Jiang. When Jiang had read the accusation, the first thing he did was ask for paper and brush. And then his funny judgment to the tune of Ta Xia Xing, a well-known popular tune, read, "The phoenix bun piles up raven black jet, the fragrant cream dazzling and smooth. The flower in the rain occupies the street in front. Her curved shoes are soaked through, so long she stood there, because there was no one who asked her deepest intention." Of course, you had to wait outside before you were allowed in, so she was drenched by the rain. "On her brows, the new sorrow, and in her hands, the document. How come she didn't ask carp or goose to deliver it? I'm afraid she is only complaining about an unfaithful lover, but this office isn't concerned with such trifling matters." So the judge refused to hear the case. And another judgment concerns a ferryman's lack of criminal crime of unfiliality. On his way to the examinations, a gentleman passed the ferry of Clear Lake in Sanchu, where he was very much abused by the ferryman. When later this gentleman had passed the examinations, he was appointed as a magistrate of Sanchu. He then tried to arrest the ferryman, but because the latter went into hiding and did not turn himself in, he then had his mother arrested. But even after 10 days, the ferryman still had not turned himself in. But as soon as he had arrested his wife and held her in jail for one day, the ferryman turned himself in. He was promptly judged as follows. And this is in nice parallel prose. "I jailed your mother for 10 days, but still you stayed in hiding. I locked your wife up for one day, and you immediately turned yourself in. How can you be so alien to the mother who is waiting for you at the gate? You are way too close to the wife to whom you were married in your youth. The case is truly one of lack of filial piety, and you deserve to be condemned to the ultimate penalty. But because of the piteous prayer of your aged mother, I will spare you from death and condemn you to stay in this city." The tradition of Huapan continued to linger in later centuries, even though I am not aware of collections exclusively devoted to the genre. Pu Sung Ling, for instance, not only on occasion would include a pan in the text of some of his stories, but in two cases he also preferred to append a pan to the text rather than the more common commentary of the historian of the strange. In both cases, it is the scandalous nature of the events narrated that inspire him to do so in the tradition of Huapan. The first case concerns the story of the woman who is found out to have to cohabit with a dog. The second case is a story entitled Huang Jiu Lang, which provides Pu Sung Ling an opportunity to make fun of homosexuality. Both of these judgments have been expertly rendered into French by André Lévy in his fine complete translation of Liao Zhaiji. Both literary and legal scholars have almost totally neglected the Pan for almost all of the 20th century. Only in recent years there has been a sudden explosion of studies of judgments as part of the growth of legal history as an academic field in China. And the genre now has received its ultimate accolade as an established genre of literature in an anthology of 300 examples of the genre, the Kudai Panzi Sandai Pian by Chen Zhongye, whose detailed annotations to the selected text have been very useful to me too. Just like the Tang Xie Sanpai Shou, the 300 poems of the Tang, once a genre becomes well established, people will compile a 300 examples of this or 300 examples of that. So 300 is a kind of canonical number for a literary anthology. Now, in this anthology, however, the overwhelming majority of judgments would, however, appear to be what are called zanze or deliberations, that is, long and elaborate case histories on occasion involving the review of earlier verdicts in the case and a discussion of the relevant laws and bylaws, resulting in a final verdict. One of our earliest collections of such case histories is the Qingmingji, or Enlightened Verdicts of the Southern Song. And many of its cases are included by Chen Zhongye in his Kudai Panzi Sanpai Pian. Chinese scholars speak in this connection of the prosification, San Wen Hua, of the Pan. From the Ming and Qing, we have, of course, collections of even more extensive case histories, both in the collections, collected writings of individual scholars and in specialized collections. Until the national and local archives were opened up, such collections of case histories were eagerly mined by scholars of legal histories. But such case histories are not Pan. The Pan continued to exist if only because it continued to be part of the examination requirements. And a flourishing publishing industry of the Ming produced many new collections of Pan for an ever-growing audience of examination candidates, and individual judges too continued to dash off Pan if the case moved them to do so. One reason for the difficulty of the Pan to establish itself as an independent literary genre in later centuries was that simple cases rarely provided the materials for an interesting Pan, and that interesting stories dwarfed the Pan that were included in such stories. From the late 16th century, we see the emergence of a body of crime fiction, best represented by the 100 cases of Judge Bao and its later derivative Lung Tu Kung An, or Cases of Judge Bao. Because the emphasis in these stories has clearly shifted to the account of the crime and the capture of the criminal, these stories are hardly, if ever, concluded by a formal pan. In story collections with higher literary aspirations, such as the San Yan compiled by Feng Menglong or the Liao Zhaiji by Pu Songling, individual stories may occasionally contain a pan. But many of such stories, however, not only contain a judgment, but also a written accusation and a written defense, which each might put its own spin on the facts of the case. Such documents submitted by the accuser and the accused had to meet certain formal requirements, and from the 11th century, handbooks circulated that provided models for such documents. Such documents never achieved the exalted rank of examination exercises, but they were of direct relevance to many in the population, and their skillful composition was a highly appreciated craft, despite the vituperation showered on the litigation masters by the magistrates and prefects who encountered them in the execution of their duties. Many narratives contain the full text of all the documents submitted and counter-submitted, trusting their readers will be able to savor their subtle points. But narratives of crime and punishment will be the subject of my later talks. For the pan to survive as an independent genre outside the context of the examinations or the story of crime, it has to feed off a well-known story. In the middle of the 17th century, Yao Tong wrote a set of six judgments in which he revisited the fate of six famous women from Chinese history and fiction. In view of Robert de Retour's lifelong interest in the story of Xuanzong and Yang Guifei, I will present a translation of Yao Tong's reversal of the judgment on Yang Guifei. And here we see, of course, this is all in parallel prose, full of allusions. A skin like snow and a face like a flower. The maids struggled to watch the mandarin ducks below their blanket. The fairest of the land ascend from heaven. She alone could match the peony flowers before the pavilion. Golden hairpins in a filigree box, she was destined to rise above the 3,000 women of the seraglio. A rainbow skirt and feather cloak earned her his affection for 10 generations. Now a point that is Chen Xuan Li, the commander of the guard that ordered her execution, now I find that this Chen Xuan Li failed to admonish the emperor as a soldier and allow the mutiny of his own officers. He only headed tired out and dispersed troops and had no understanding of the battle arrays of love. A mountain of ice, he lacked all style, so it is fitting he should receive the punishment of the meandering stream. Her jade arms were not bewitching, so how could he bear to discard the covering embroidered blanket? Her perfume sachet and brocade sock were idly left at Ma Wei's slope. Her false chignon and yellow skirt were both buried in the parent's grave. How could it be that a son of heaven would be incapable of protecting a single beauty? What kind of general would dare act against an honored consort? The retired emperor wept tears when he heard the sound of the rustling rain. The master of magic dispatched his soul and was moved by her tale of the 77 event. The primary evildoer, Chen Xuan Li, should be executed as a regicide to warn the army. Secondarily, according to the statute for applying force, his punishment should be increased by one level. Yao Tong's literary judgments were repeatedly reprinted in later times, for instance, as the Meiren Pan, or Judgments on Beautiful Women in the Xiangyan Zongshu, this huge compilation of writings on women. They also invited some imitations. For instance, the Kujin Wenchuan, a selection of humorous writings from past and present by a man called Lei Jin, compiled during the early years of the 20th century, contains, for instance, not only the judgments by Yao Tong, but also a few imitations by the late Qing early Republican writer Sun Yu Shou, who otherwise is better known for his fairy tales. But Jotun not only wrote Pan to restore the honor of maligned women of the past, he also used the genre to condemn the rats that had destroyed the manuscript of a set of poems composed while making a trip by boat. And so I will conclude by reading to you his judgment for the dismemberment of a rat. I had prepared a neat copy of the poems of my northward journey, written while on the boat, but one night the manuscript was stolen by a rat. It had been almost completely chewed to pieces, and as I was furious, I wrote the following text in jest. A request to the censor-in-chief. When the Qin collapsed after two generations, the first of its fault was the burning of the books. When the Han established the code of three chapters, these severely punished the rifling of boxes. How doltish is this fierce rat that plays the king on my light boat. As it constantly finds enjoyment on the streams, it now happily partakes of vegetal nourishment. But how could it, under the cover of the dark night, dare steal my new poems? Separate stanzas and selected lines entered into your mouth, while broken strips and tattered sheets were left below my bed. Now, for the rare words of the philosopher Yang Xiong, it was still a shame to cover a jar. And the brocade bag of the poet Li He was dishonored when thrown into a privy. How much more does that apply to this disaster, which even doubles that of the former worthies? These poems of evaluating the breeze and fashioning the moon only provided food to the teeth that bore through rooms. Works of cooking a crane and burning a zither all ended up filling a stomach that can drink a river. Alas, the cosmos fashioned by Fuxi and Shengnong is supported by both tortoise and dragon. When the Prince of Huainan completed his undertaking, chickens and dogs joined him in his ascension. You are not carried aloft by a phoenix, but will only encounter screeching owls. When heaven is about to destroy you, how could such a small creature know? Considering that when silver fishes ruin a book, they are submitted to the execution of a single word, how can you escape the law of the five punishments when you devour my manuscripts like squirrels? If Li Si would see you, he would hate you more than a granary thief. If Jiang Tang was still alive, your crime would surpass the theft of meat. The judgment may be transmitted to the great general Miao with vicious whiskers, so he may execute your dismemberment according to the law. But more on rats and cats next week. Thank you very much.